Good afternoon, and welcome to our Character in the Professions Conference. My name is Kenneth Townsend, and I am Director of Leadership and Character in the Professional Schools and Scholar in Residence in the School of Law here at Wake Forest. For those who have participated in previous sessions, welcome back. And for those joining for the first time, welcome. We have had over 2,300 registrants from across the United States and 37 countries sign up for this conference. And along with the Oxford Character Project, we in the Program for Leadership and Character are delighted to have you for this, our final session. Thanks also to all of our conference partners and funders who have helped make this conference possible. Before introducing our featured speaker, I must first reference someone else. The Stanford Law School's Deborah Rohde agreed last May to be our featured speaker for this Character in Law session. She shared with me an almost final draft of her paper for the conference last December. It was entitled Character in Law, the Bar's Misplaced Focus and Why It Matters. Sadly, just a few days after sharing this almost final draft, Professor Rohde passed away unexpectedly. Her passing has been felt by so many, and we want to remember and honor her with today's program. Professor Rohde's colleagues have been so helpful in helping us navigate the loss and trying to find a proper replacement, which is very difficult given the shoes that she has left to fill. But it is my distinct honor to introduce to you one of her colleagues and partners, Professor Debbie Muckamal. Debbie is the executive director of the Stanford Criminal Justice Center at Stanford Law School. She has co-directed Renewing Communities, a statewide initiative to expand college opportunities for incarcerated and formerly incarcerated students in California, led the center's efforts to address the admission bars to law school and the state bar for people with criminal records, and co-founded and run Project Remade, an entrepreneurship boot camp for people with criminal records. Professor Muckamal's presentation today will touch on and amplify portions of Professor Rohde's paper, Character in Law, while also drawing upon some of her recent work in California, including a report she co-authored entitled Unlocking the Bar, a report that, among other things, calls upon the legal profession to think more broadly about the role of character in the practice of law. This afternoon, following Professor Muckamal's presentation, we will have time for questions from the audience. The chat function is disabled, so please use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen to ask questions. My colleagues and I will field these questions and present them directly to Professor Muckamal. We will not, however, have audience Q&A following the later panel discussion, but we do hope that you will stay with us for this really engaging panel discussion that features a range of all-stars and will be moderated by our Dean Jane Aiken of the Wake Forest School of Law. So without anything further, welcome Professor Muckamal. We are grateful to hear from you today. And are you on the screen? Go ahead and click there we go. Welcome so much. Thank you so much, especially under the circumstances. We're so grateful to have you with us today and are excited to hear what you have to share with us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And thank you especially to Kenneth and the other conference organizers for your superb organization. Most of you are probably here because you thought my very esteemed colleague, Deborah Rohde, was giving this address. I wish she was too. Although tiny in physical stature, Professor Rohde was a giant in the legal profession, doing more through her academic scholarship to advance justice, access to justice, moral character, and gender issues than any law professor ever has. I can't replace Deborah, but I hope my remarks pay due respect to her unmatched and revered legacy. What I hope to do this afternoon is to elevate a few of the themes that Deborah explored in her brilliant essay on the role of character in the legal profession. If you haven't already done so, I encourage you to read her paper. I'll be talking about what our center undertook to better understand whether and how qualified people with criminal records have access to the California State Bar. This was research and advocacy that built directly off and was influenced by Deborah Rohde's decades-long scholarship on moral character. I plan to leave ample time at the end and hope we can engage in robust discussion in memory of Professor Rohde. I'll be focusing on California, though the themes we uncovered are not unique to the Golden State. We had access to California State Bar officials and California law school officials that made undertaking the research easier. Also, the work grew from adjacent work we were doing to expand college opportunities for currently and formerly incarcerated students in California. Professor Rohde asserts in her paper that the legal profession cares deeply about character. Indeed, every state requires that new applicants to the legal profession demonstrate good moral character. The American Bar Association's model rules of professional conduct maintain that as an officer of the legal system, each lawyer has a duty to uphold the legal process, to demonstrate respect for the legal system, and to further the public's confidence in the rule of law and justice system. Despite this supposed focus, Professor Rohde identifies myriad ways the bar has fallen short in achieving the aspirations laid out by the model rules. As she states, the profession has done too little to reinforce models of exemplary character as the guide for daily practice. The bar can and must do better, and society has a substantial stake in demanding it. No occupation provides such a high percentage of America's leaders. To be sure, the stakes are high. The legal profession is essential to a functioning democracy, and the public benefits when people are qualified for and committed to entering the legal profession have a fair chance to serve as lawyers. In the first part of her essay, Deborah discusses the bar's century-long history of using moral character requirements to gatekeep the profession. Moral character screening has sordid origins. Its rise was motivated in part by nativist, ethnic, and anti-Semitic biases, and it has been used as a means of restricting the admission of Black, Jewish, and immigrant applicants. The standards for disqualification in the early 20th century were decidedly vague, and at least one county board in 1929 was rejecting candidates based on such qualities as being subnormal, unprepossessing, shifty, smooth, keen, shrewd, arrogant, or surly. Examiners claimed that they could discern from interviews whether candidates lacked moral stamina or a proper sense of right and wrong. And as late as the mid-1980s, the moral character requirement was being used by some state bar examiners to deny admission based on applicants' peaceful protest activities and sexual orientations. While moral character standards for both admission and disciplinary stages have become common, they were and are inconsistently applied and haphazard. In some jurisdictions, seemingly minor or unrelated past conduct have made an applicant ineligible, whereas more serious and related past conduct was not disqualifying in other jurisdictions. Such inconsistencies might be understandable. In fact, the Supreme Court has described character requirements as unusually ambiguous and has avoided specifying what constitutes good moral character, requiring instead and merely that there be a rational connection standard between the character criteria and the applicant's fitness or capacity to practice law. Despite all requiring that their applicants possess good moral character, most states define it vaguely. And in fact, many states use the term without actually defining its meaning. Oklahoma, for example, simply states that the applicant shall have good moral character, due respect for the law, and fitness to practice law. Nine other states have similarly opaque standards. In the states that have defined moral character, the definition is often a list of character traits that provides insufficient guidance to the applicant. California's definition includes a non-exhaustive list of character traits. Good moral character includes, but is not limited to, qualities of honesty, fairness, candor, trustworthiness, observance of fiduciary responsibility, respect for and obedience to the law, and respect for the rights of others and the judicial process. This broad, non-specific definition mirrors that of many other states. Professor Rohde points to the inherent difficulty the bar, like other licensing authorities, has in determining the relationship between past conduct with predictions of future misconduct. As she says, moral conduct reflects a complex interrelationship between traits and situations, and contextual norms, incentives, and pressures have a substantial impact on ethical conduct. Knowing that someone engaged in unethical conduct in the past is insufficient to predicting that they will do so again, the bar would also need to know why the person engaged in the behavior, but that is really hard to do. Today, the moral character review process for bar admission involves screening applicants for a range of past behaviors, including their criminal records. In doing so, and without intention, the moral character review process will likely reflect the racial disparities that plague the US criminal justice system as a whole. In California, for instance, whites comprise more than a third of the state population, but only a quarter of the prison population. More notably, Blacks make up almost 30% of the prison population, but only 6.5% of the state population. Moral character screening that involves criminal record review is likely to perpetuate the underrepresentation of people of color in an already exceptionally non-diverse population profession. At precisely the same time that the legal bar has amplified efforts to diversify the profession and address structural racism. Moreover, given current societal conditions, admissions policies that consider an applicant's criminal record are likely to affect a significant number of people. Massive numbers of individuals in the United States have criminal records today, over 70 million individuals, or over one-fifth of the US population. In addition, growing number of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people now have access to college opportunities and will have the educational qualifications to pursue legal professions. As a result, more qualified candidates than ever before may be prevented from realizing legal careers by admission policies that screen based on criminal records. Indeed, more than any other state in the nation, California's public higher education system is now reaching men and women who have been adversely impacted by mass incarceration, whether they are in prison, jail, or on our college campuses. As of 2018, 34 out of 30 of California's 35 state prisons offer face-to-face, full-credit, degree-building college courses. More than 5,000 students are enrolled in these face-to-face college pathways each semester, or about the same size as MIT's undergraduate class. And they have consistently outperformed students on campus. In addition, one third of California's college campuses and more than half of its 23 California State University campuses now have a formal or informal support program for formerly incarcerated students, with that number continuing to grow. While protection of the public is the primary justification for screening applicants for their criminal records, evidence suggests that doing so at the time of bar admission is not a good predictor of subsequent misconduct, and when used, may be ineffective and overly broad, undermining the goals of the screening itself. As Professor Rohde noted in her essay, a Connecticut study from 2002 reviewed 1,300 bar applicants and their subsequent disciplinary records, but couldn't identify any factors at the admission stage that could have predicted the subsequent misconduct. Desistance studies also show that there is a certain period of time after which an individual who commits a crime will be no more likely to commit another crime than someone who had never committed a crime in her life. Moreover, a growing body of empirical and survey research demonstrates that in the workplace, individuals with a criminal record perform equally to or better than their counterparts with no criminal records. There is a phenomenon of people with criminal records desiring to give back and seek professional avenues like human services, social work, and the law as a means of using their own personal experiences to advocate on behalf of others. A number of federal and state laws reflect this body of research by limiting how colleges, employers, and other decision makers may consider applicants' criminal records. These regulations, sometimes referred to as ban the box policies, usually require that there be a nexus between the job being sought and the criminal record. They throw out old convictions and forbid the use of arrests that didn't lead to conviction in decision-making. What is at stake when we screen in ways that are arbitrary, discriminatory, or empirically ill-grounded? Who do we risk losing to contribute to the legal profession? Let me share some prominent examples of formerly incarcerated individuals who went on to become successful lawyers. Tara Simmons spent years in prison and jail as a result of convictions stemming from her addiction. After her release and after receiving treatment for her addiction and trauma, she graduated from law school, but was denied the ability to sit for the Washington State Bar after the Bar's Character and Fitness Board found her to lack moral character. She took her case to the Washington Supreme Court, and then in a unanimous opinion, the court reversed the board's decision. She was awarded a Skadden Fellowship, practiced law at the Public Defender Association in Seattle, and in this last November, she was elected to the Washington State Legislature, where she now serves on the Civil Rights and Judiciary, Healthcare and Wellness, Public Safety, and Rules Committees, being the first formerly incarcerated person in the state's history to do so. Sean Hopwood is a second conspicuous example. He spent years in federal prison for several bank robberies, but after release went on to become a member of the Washington State Bar and then a professor at Georgetown Law School. He now draws on his experiences to advance reforms to the criminal justice system through appellate representation and research scholarship. Frankie Guzman is a third. He was sentenced to California's prison for youth multiple times, including for stealing a car and robbing a liquor store before he went on to graduate from UCLA School of Law and to join the California State Bar. In 2012, he was awarded a Soros Justice Fellowship to join the National Center for Youth Law. He has remained there since as an attorney, advocating on behalf of at-risk youth and for reform to the juvenile justice system he had experienced firsthand as a teenager. Recently, his leadership contributed both to the establishment of the California System-Involved Bar Association and a state law that prevents young people from being charged as adults in the California criminal justice system. Each of these examples demonstrate the unique value formerly incarcerated people can bring to the legal profession. From 2015 to 2020, we co-led statewide work to expand access to college opportunities for incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people in California. We found that as the educational achievements of these new college students grew, their professional aspirations did too. They sought more than a job. They wanted careers. And as I stated earlier, they were attracted by professions that enabled them to help others, to give back. Ironically, it is these same professions where their criminal records would create legal barriers. So as an extension of our work on opening access to college opportunities, we wanted to better understand the extent to which people with criminal records are blocked from the legal profession. In that vein, we undertook original research and made several significant findings. And I should say as a sidebar that the research I'm going to speak about was undertaken as a policy lab at Stanford with students working alongside me and my colleagues at the Stanford Criminal Justice Center and at Deborah Rohde's Center on the Legal Profession. I'm happy to talk more about that, about how those policy labs work, if that's of interest. So anyway, here's what we found. We found that there are successive barriers that exist to keep people with criminal records from joining the legal profession, and that it is not just the state bar that gatekeeps, but that those barriers come much earlier. So first, individuals with criminal records are deterred from applying to law school in the first place. We surveyed 88 individuals with criminal records across the United States, all who identify themselves as criminal justice leaders. Over half cited the concern of passing the moral character requirement as one of the top three reasons for why they had not yet applied for law school. As one admitted in our survey, "I thought because I had a felony, there was no chance, so I never tried." Law schools serve as the first formal gatekeepers. We talked with deans of admission from 10 ABA accredited California law schools, representing a range of tiers and both public and private law schools. We also reviewed the disclosure requirements for 20 ABA accredited California law schools, again at a range of tiers and both public and private schools. And we spoke to a number of student services deans at a number of law schools as well. Among the admissions deans, most, 7 out of 10, said that their school considered the California State Bar's moral character requirement when crafting their own disclosure requirements. And 8 in 10 consider whether an applicant would pass the State Bar's moral character component when making admissions decisions. ABA standard 501B requires that law school admissions officers deny applicants who do not appear capable of being admitted to the bar. and several of our admissions deans referenced that standard as one of the reasons for their policies. Several, as one officer explained to us, one of the primary functions of a law school is to prepare individuals to be members of the bar. So to ignore moral character misses the point of what a law school is supposed to do. Another admissions officer shared that her law school asked for applicants' criminal histories because we have a moral duty to help our students get through the bar so that they don't waste 3 or 4 years and $180,000. We would not consider admitting first and then asking later. In addition to the moral character requirement, admissions officers pointed to safety, liability concerns, and a desire to assess applicants' judgment for their reasons for requiring criminal record disclosures. Applicants must answer different questions about their criminal records for each different law school they apply to, making it difficult for the applicant to craft a single statement that explains their criminal record. For example, half of the law schools we spoke to and looked at require applicants to disclose past arrests, even if those arrests did not lead to charges, and the other half not. Similarly, while 3 of the 20 law schools explicitly do not require applicants to disclose expunged convictions, about a third of the law schools do, and the rest are unclear about whether expunged convictions must be disclosed or not. As a result, an applicant may be in the position of disclosing different information about her criminal record, depending on the particular requirements of each school to which she's applying. Moreover, in many cases, it's not clear what criminal record information a particular law school requires the applicant to disclose. For example, in our analysis of the 20 ABA-accredited California law schools moral character disclosure questions, we were unable to determine for at least half of the schools whether they wanted applicants to disclose juvenile offenses, sealed offenses, or dismissed offenses. Also, the criminal record information that law school asks applicants to disclose differs from the criminal record information that the California State Bar asks applicants to disclose. In many cases, law schools ask applicants for more information than the bar asks for, even though the admissions deans indicated that one of the reasons for asking the questions is because of what the state bar asks. In many cases, law schools ask applicants, as I said, for more information. Finally, admissions officers lack access to information and training relevant to making informed moral character determinations. Admissions officers estimated that as low as 1% and as high as 25% of the applicant pool to their respective schools disclose criminal record issues each year. The most common disclosures are substance-related offenses like drug possession, driving under the influence, and public intoxication. And half of the admissions officers we interviewed stated that they had no policy for reviewing applications with criminal record disclosure and no single expert they can turn to understand the relevance of an applicant's criminal record. Most will follow up with applicants from whom they need more information or context to reach a decision, but only 2 indicated that they requested court documents, and even these 2 do so very rarely. None conducts a criminal background check, and none offers in-person interviews to applicants with conduct issues. Indeed, at least 2 admissions officers stated that they consider it a negative to need to follow up with applicants for more information. Once matriculated to law school, law students with criminal records continue to face barriers that block their access to the legal profession. Law schools differ in terms of the level of communication that takes place between admissions officers and student services officers regarding admitted students with criminal records. Student services officers with more information reported being better able to proactively engage and aid those students who may need individual assistance. We also found that most law schools discuss the state bar's moral character requirements with law students at some point during the student's first year of school. But there's considerable variety in how student services counsel students about and assist with their applications. Some are very hands-on, meeting with those who have potential moral character issues during their first year, Whereas other schools leave it to the students to find assistance with attorneys who specialize in representing applicants with moral character screening, representation which can cost upwards of $15,000. Finally, certain unique issues arise for law students with criminal records in addition to those posed by applying for state bar admission. In particular, students with criminal records encounter unique challenges in seeking employment, and they may experience learning about and discussing criminal law topics differently than do their peers with less direct exposure and experience with the criminal justice system. For instance, one student told us that he wasn't sure when and how to disclose his criminal record to a summer employer who had made a post-graduation offer to him. He said that the career services staff at his law school didn't know how to advise him either. The state bar's moral character review process serves as the final gatekeeper. When we examined the California State Bar's moral character review process, we found a number of barriers. For instance, the California State Bar asks applicants and their law schools different questions about the applicants' backgrounds. The State Bar asks law schools, but not law students, to provide them with records related to students' arrests, even if the arrest did not lead to a conviction. And the State Bar asks law students about their expunged convictions, but doesn't ask law schools to report that information about their students. Second, some of the criminal record information that the California State Bar asked was legally imprecise. For instance, the bar asked law schools whether a student was charged informally with a violation of the law, even though informal charge is a legally meaningless category. While a criminal record does not categorically preclude an applicant from being admitted to the California State Bar, applicants who have been convicted of violent felonies, felonies involving moral turpitude, and crimes involving a breach of fiduciary duty were presumed not to be of good moral character in the absence of a pardon or showing of overwhelming reform and rehabilitation. These terms also carry imprecision. Violent is a moral and descriptive term, not by itself a formal legal term or category. Moreover, where the term violent felony appears in federal and state statutes, it can have widely variant criteria depending on the legal context. The same is true for crimes of moral turpitude. Not only does this vagueness lead to confusion for applicants, it may also lead to inconsistent decisions by the state bar. A few states' rules explicitly specify that certain types of criminal history will either be an absolute bar to admission or may constitute grounds for recommending denial. In Mississippi, for example, felonies and certain other convictions are an absolute bar to the practice of law. Alabama prevents an applicant from admission unless she has received a full pardon for her crime and the full restoration of her civil rights. Georgia requires applicants to have received one or the other. In Idaho, a conviction of a serious crime constitutes criteria for disqualification of an applicant on character and fitness grounds. And serious crime is defined as any felony as well as any lesser crime that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer. Similarly, in New Hampshire, criminal acts, whether or not the conduct results in a prosecution and conviction, and even though the arrest and or conviction for the conduct may have been annulled, may be grounds for the committee to recommend denial of admission for lack of character and fitness. In many states, a criminal history that includes certain kinds of crimes will create a rebuttable presumption that the applicant lacks good moral character. California had such a rebuttable presumption for certain kinds of crimes, as I mentioned earlier, until very recently. The California State Bar, like most state bars, places great value on applicants' candor. Various stakeholders we spoke to raised concerns about quote unquote candor traps into which applicants can and sometimes do fall. The potential exists for applicants to inadvertently fail to disclose required information about their criminal history, and this inadvertent disclosure may be perceived by state bar officials as an intentional omission indicative of the applicant's lack of candor. Candor traps are common for a number of reasons. Rap sheets are routinely inaccurate. Students are misinformed by attorneys that their records are clean when they are not. And the records reported to the state bar are often different from the ones the subject of the record can review. The composition of the decision-making body is also a factor. In California, there are no requirements that any members of the committee that determines whether or not an applicant has good moral character, has special training or expertise in substance abuse, mental health, financial management, or any other substantive area of value to the committee. This differs from other states. In Wyoming, for instance, the committee is comprised of four members, one of whom is a non-lawyer with special training in substance abuse, mental health, financial management, and other subject expertise. Finally, the state bar's data collection and transparency policies reinforces a lack of access. The bar seals its admissions decisions and does not collect or share data on moral character determinations. It does not publicly provide on its website or otherwise examples of the kinds of criminal convictions they see among applicants that have and have not been granted admission. And until recently, it didn't provide concrete examples of the quantity and character of evidence that successful applicants produce to prove their rehabilitation. As a result, prospective law students and lawyers, law school student services officers, and other relevant actors lack access to useful information about the moral character review process. Finally, and as Deborah Rohde noted in her paper about many other states, California's processes and standards for attorney discipline differ from its processes and standards for attorney admission. A number of differences stand out, including those between the standards of evidence and burdens of proof imposed on each process, the types of activity that engender scrutiny, the possible consequences of an adverse finding. The question remains, are we spending more time erecting barriers to the profession when we should be expending resources to ensure the profession upholds its character ideals? How might we reverse the direction of this pipeline and expand access to qualified people with criminal records? And how would such strategies benefit other disenfranchised groups, groups the bar might be trying to attract? Let me offer a few quick recommendations. One is to create a law school admissions pipeline where we might conduct greater outreach to formerly incarcerated students and those with criminal records to share information about law school and state bar admissions processes and dispel myths about how criminal records affect admission. The growing number of college support programs for formerly incarcerated students could serve as an ideal venue for such outreach. We could also collect and disseminate profiles of successful lawyers who were incarcerated prior to seeking bar admission. To mitigate the deterrent effect, we need to elevate the success of others, demonstrating that it is not only possible to overcome the moral character screening, but that the profession welcomes them and their unique expertise. We need to reform law school admission policies and practices. We should provide professional development on desistance, implicit bias, and other relevant research to law school admission staff and others making admissions decisions, and institute admission policies for applicants with criminal records that are evidence-based and applied consistently across applicants. We might consider standardizing criminal history disclosure questions and requirements on law school applications so that applicants can prepare a single but comprehensive statement about their criminal history. We should think about targeting student services to support law students with criminal records once they're in law school. We should develop best practices to ensure that students who are formerly incarcerated or have criminal records are adequately supported while they're enrolled, including informing them about the moral character review process early in their studies so that they have adequate time to compile a strong application, and providing individual counseling to these students on how and when to disclose their criminal records to potential employers and on how to navigate state bar moral character processes. We might also provide professional development to faculty and staff to ensure that they are equipped to sensitively and more effectively respond to the particular needs of students with criminal records in the classroom and in the law school community. We might also connect advocates to assist formerly incarcerated students applying for state bar admission. We might develop networks to connect state bar applicants who have criminal records to pro bono lawyers who can assist them in their applications, and develop training to pro bono attorneys willing to assist these applicants with their moral character screening. And finally, what might we do with the state bar admissions policies and practices themselves? We might think about eliminating certain kinds of records from the review process. We want to make sure that the state bar's moral character decisions are grounded in and driven by relevant research and mitigate any discriminatory effects the moral character review process may have, including by requiring that at least some members of the committee have a background in psychology, substance abuse, mental health, or other areas of value, and providing professional development to the state bar staff and committee members that includes training on desistance and other relevant topics. We might also require that the state bar enhance the clarity, transparency, and accessibility of the state bar's moral character standards and processes, including by ensuring that the state bar provides more and clear guidance that is comprehensible to lawyers and non-lawyers alike, and that they collect and disseminate yearly statistics on applicants with criminal records and their admission rates. Such information would help applicants, but also law schools who are preparing students for bar admission. Sometimes one's research is perfectly timed. Ours was. In 2019, as we were finishing up this research, the State Bar convened a working group to elevate the standards applied to moral character determinations. The goal of the work group was to review existing processes and to develop clear and appropriate guidelines for determining whether an applicant possesses the requisite moral character. As my invitation to the working group indicated, the bar hoped that the group would create policies and processes that ensure greater uniformity and consistency in decision-making, provide transparency into the moral character evaluation process, and ensure the state bar provides appropriate consideration for rehabilitative efforts undertaken by applicants. As you can imagine, I was keen to join this group. The work group included 7 members, 3 members of the Committee of Bar Examiners, and 3 deans of California-based law schools. I was the 7th member. The task force convened for 9 months, and I'm proud to say that all before COVID hit, and just before COVID hit, because our last meeting was in February of last year, we made and had approved by the Committee of Bar Examiners, the State Bar Board of Trustees, and the California Supreme Court, all of which are required review when you're making any kind of policy changes at the State Bar. And here's what we accomplished. We updated the moral character statement to elevate the values of transparency and emphasize the consideration of rehabilitation. The statement now reads, "The process for making a moral character determination for those seeking admission to the State Bar of California and a license to practice law shall be uniform, consistent with governing law, and transparent. The process shall adhere to best practices and ensure that appropriate consideration is given to rehabilitative efforts undertaken by applicants." Perhaps most importantly, what the working group did is to develop transparent guidelines that the State Bar could use and make available to applicants. The guidelines are characterized by 4 sets of character traits set out in the governing law. So that is respect for and obedience to a law, which pertains to felony and misdemeanor convictions, juvenile records, and vehicle code infractions. Honesty, candor, trustworthiness, fairness, which would include honor code violations, job terminations, omission of information, fraudulent activity. 3rd, observance of fiduciary and financial responsibilities, including issues like bankruptcy, past due debt, and unpaid income taxes. And 4th, respect for the rights of others and judicial process. So that would cover instances of malpractice, professional discipline, court sanctions, malpractice, military discipline, and civil actions. For each category, the matrix identifies the level of review that would likely be required and the types of mitigating or aggravating factors that will be considered. So for instance, for a nonviolent conviction that is more than 5 years old, it's not likely to require additional inquiry, but a violent one will. And the matrix guides the applicant as to what evidence the bar will weigh heavily in determining the relevance of the misconduct. So for a criminal record, the age of the person when the misconduct occurred, the social factors that might have contributed to the misconduct, and rehabilitation directly tied to the misconduct are among the factors the State Bar says are probative. This specific information for each type of potential misconduct is something that the State Bar never had before and which is now incredibly welcome by both applicants and by law school admissions directors who were trying to get more specific information about what the state bar will consider for applicants. And then the other two things that the working group did was to eliminate discrepancies between what the bar was asking of law students and what it was asking law schools about those law students, so that that information is now in alignment. And it eliminated the presumption of ineligibility standard that once existed for violent felonies and felonies involving moral turpitude. The standard now reads, there is no criminal act that disqualifies an applicant from receiving a positive moral character determination given a sufficient showing of rehabilitation. Where serious misconduct occurs, positive inferences about the applicant's moral character are more difficult to draw, and negative character inferences are stronger. When there have been serious acts of moral turpitude, the applicant must demonstrate that he or she behaved in an exemplary fashion over a meaningful period of time. Criminal acts not involving moral turpitude, such as some acts of civil disobedience, do not provide a basis for a negative moral character determination, absent evidence beyond the act's criminal nature that shows it demonstrates a lack of good moral character. Shifting the presumption signals to formerly incarcerated applicants that their aspirations don't need to be uniquely tied to their criminal records. All of these changes were made in tandem with a new process that emphasizes staff decision making over the committee of bar examiners members making those decisions, thereby making the consistency of decision making more probable. I want to think that Deborah Rohde would approve of all the changes that we made. Finally, Professor Rohde urges all members of the bar to elevate qualities of character and service of the profession in our democracy. She says the profession needs to do more to help lawyers develop and nurture qualities of character, as well as the support structures necessary to sustain them. Our system of justice and democratic institutions depend on it. It is unquestionably legitimate and important to protect the public from the risk of lawyers who, even if intellectually qualified, may disserve their clients and the legal system through fraudulent or deceptive conduct. As we law school administrators, mentors to law students and young graduates, attorneys at large and small law firms, legislators and policymakers manifest this mandate, may our commitment to uphold our profession's moral character be steadfast, but also narrowly tailored so that we can simultaneously pursue equally important societal goals, like encouraging rehabilitation and successful reentry, recognizing redemption when it occurs, promoting diversity, and addressing structural racism. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Professor Muckamal. This is really interesting, and it's so impressive, all of what you have done, and to see the tangible results, I know has to be pretty neat. So we do have some questions that have started to come in, and you do have a Q&A box down there at the bottom of your screen. Feel free to add in your questions for Debbie. But before we get started on that, one thing that strikes me as I listened to your presentation concerned the various dimensions of character, including character of the institutions that train lawyers, the character of individual lawyers and lawyers to be, as well as the character of the legal profession itself. So what I heard you say in so much of your work on this report, it seems to reflect a commitment to virtues of justice, fairness, and mercy when determining who is eligible to join the profession. But as we move forward in this conversation, it might be helpful for us to think about these different dimensions of character, both individual questions of character as well as institutional and professional questions of character. Not so much a question, but a framing to keep in mind as we move forward. So our first question is as follows. How do you think that legal education and or the legal profession can best promote the particular virtues that are needed for lawyers to practice and lead with integrity without falling prey to the limitations associated with some of the moral character requirements that have been so unfairly applied in the past?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would refer everybody to Deborah's article because I think she addresses that head on in her essay. Both in terms of thinking about how we gatekeep at the front end and where we put our resources. Deborah was one who thought very passionately that we put we put more resources keeping people out and not enough resources making sure that the bad apples are not kicked out, as she liked to say. So I think that, but I think in Deborah's essay, and she's thought a lot more about this than I have, I mean, she speaks really passionately about what we need to be doing to call out when our fellow attorneys and members of the bar are not living up to the character standard that we really are supposed to uphold, and that we shouldn't shy away from that sort of calling out. And then I think the third part of her essay is really about what are the kinds of efforts that we can be making to make sure that, particularly, and I know in the next panel, you have a lot of fabulous deans who are going to be speaking, where do we cultivate that in professional school so that those attributes get ingrained in our young graduates and sustain them in their professional careers? So I guess in answering your question, I would refer people to the paper, and Kenneth, I'm assuming it's on your website, or we can make it available somehow.
Yeah, we will be making it available. It is not quite in a final form. We're making some final
edit,
but it will be available. And our expectation is, I don't have an exact timeline for this, but for those wondering, our hope is, and expectation is, to produce an edited volume that will include each of the presentations that were made for this conference, including Deborah Rohde's posthumously as part of that volume. But we'll have a draft version of that available. We just want to make sure that whatever goes out in a broader way is cleared with various folks at Stanford, including some people who she had worked with. So our next question is from Rich, who asks, do you think that nonviolent convictions are less problematic than violent convictions? I serve on my state bar's grievance committee. We have a steady stream of lawyers being disciplined that have substance abuse problems. Bar applicants that have a criminal history involving drug abuse or theft-related offenses related to funding a drug addiction should raise many red flags, especially for attorney misconduct related to theft of client funds. I do not see the same problem with bar applicants having violent convictions that do not indicate an addiction.
It's such a great question. And I would refer Rich to our paper, because there's a really great discussion of the desistance literature. We summarize the desistance literature, and as it looks at, you know, the likelihood of someone, depending on the type of crime that they've been convicted of, whether or not that be like a robbery versus a nonviolent offense versus something else, what's the likelihood of that happening again? I'd also just call out that for individuals who've been convicted of violent offenses, they've likely already spent a lot of time in prison. They've likely, quote unquote, aged out of crime. And thirdly, they've already undergone likely some kind of review process from a parole board that has dealt with some of the character issues that a character and fitness committee would also be looking at. They're looking at things like insight. Does the individual have insight to what their role was in the crime that was convicted? How do they think about that? And so that's already happened. And so by the time that individual with a violent criminal record comes to the character and fitness bar, they've already gone through, there's been a lot of time that has passed. There's been, you know, it could be upwards of 20 years since the conviction happened. And so some of those red flags that you might be thinking about with someone who's had a substance abuse addiction aren't there. Many of the state bars also require, you know, some level of for those who have substance abuse addictions to go through some level of treatment. They sometimes have provide provisional, provisional review, requiring that the person go through treatment before they, you know, are deemed to have final, to be finally approved by the character committee. But I would really encourage you to look at our paper, Unlocking the Bar, because it does have a nice section on desistance.
And that I will be putting in the chat momentarily. That is final and can be read. You can Google it, but I'll put it in the chat shortly.
Thank you.
The next question we have is from Patricia Murphy, who asks if you can comment on the sufficiency of the requirement of good moral character as opposed to determining that one is not of poor moral character. So I'm not sure if you want to take this from a practical, what does California say about this, or a more theoretical answer. Is it more important for lawyers to have good moral character or just not have bad moral character?
Yeah, I would say that what at least from my examination of California, that I think they're more looking for that you don't have bad moral character. They're not looking necessarily that you have good moral character. So they're not elevating. They're not necessarily elevating attributes that they're looking to see what misconduct you have in your background. So that's why they're looking at, like, what's your bankruptcy record? Where's your failure to pay income taxes? What's your past criminal record? They're not asking you to present like positive rehabilitation. They are sometimes asking for positive rehabilitation. For people with criminal records, we used to jokingly say to the state bar, it looks like you're asking for Mother Teresa, because you ask that, you indicate that, like, you know, community service is not enough, because we as lawyers are expected to do community service. And so you really need to go above and beyond what's actually just required by any law student or by any attorney. So I would think that they're more looking for that. And that might be a shift that we might be able to do that is really more about being aspirational than about sort of correcting bad misconduct. It's a great question. And great. Something really interesting to chew on. Mm-hmm. And I would think that maybe the next panel probably has a lot to say about that.
Yeah, and thanks also for fielding some questions that might be more roadie oriented questions. So thanks.
It's okay. I'm really happy to say when I don't know what I don't know.
No, you're doing a great job. I think this is another question that is somewhat roadie oriented, but I think can be answered relatively easily by you as well. And it reads as, Professor Rohde has indicated that the bar has done little to elevate exemplary legal leaders. Who do you think are exemplary lawyers that could provide relevant examples for us today?
Oh, wow. Well, okay. So I work in the criminal justice space. It's a more narrow part of the legal profession, but I look at someone like Brian Stevenson, who heads the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama, as someone to hold up as a hero, who's used his legal training to not only address problems in the criminal justice system, but also used his legal training to mentor, really take a responsibility for mentoring young people and young lawyers and law students, but also to provide public education. So if you haven't been to Montgomery to see the Legacy Museum that the Equal Justice Initiative started, that to me is like an example of kind of using those law skills in a public education context that's really sort of exemplary. That's just one. I bet you have a bunch of examples, Kenneth, that you would offer.
And I bet our panel to follow will also consider perhaps this question.
Yeah.
Brian Stevenson is a role model to so many. I think that is a fantastic example.
He was the very, just to personally, he was the very first person I heard speak when I was in law school.
Oh, right.
Like fantastic. 30 years ago. So, yeah.
My wife just finished reading Just Mercy, and actually it was involved in a conversation between the Program for Leadership and Character and the Oxford Character Project. So Just Mercy has been on some of our radars just in the last.
Oh, that's great.
We only have a few minutes left. And this is another roadie-oriented question that, you know, to some extent, I think you can maybe weigh in on, but, you know, maybe channel Deborah in so doing. Throughout her career, Professor Rohde argued that lawyers are in some ways morally responsible for the work that they do and the clients that they represent. But this doesn't square perfectly with the so-called neutral partisan theory of lawyering that prioritizes a lawyer's duty to represent clients with zeal. Do you have any advice for how lawyers can seek integration between their values and their work while also taking seriously our duties to clients, including those clients whose values we don't always embrace?
Oh, what a great question, isn't it? Professor Rohde talks about that in some detail in her essay as well, if I remember, Kenneth. I don't know that I have anything brilliant to add to that, because I think it is, those things can feel like they're in opposition to one another, but I don't think that they have to be. I think that what Deborah suggests is that there's ways to be able to do both, and that at some point there is a place where you do actually have to speak up, or you have to say, no, I won't do this, because it goes beyond sort of being the neutral partisan advocate that you signed up to be. And that probably where that place is different for everybody. Mm-hmm. But that nevertheless, we should be speaking about that there is a boundary for which we should not go beyond, even if that is different for everybody.
I think that's well put. And that's one of the things I tell my students is, I'm not going to tell you exactly where to draw that line, but asking questions about the relationship and where lines can be drawn can be a first important step. So we're almost out of time. So I'm going to ask one last question. Sure. You referenced towards the end of your talk, support structures. The term support structures for supporting character came up. So what support structures do you think are necessary to sustain the character traits that lawyers need to be good and ethical lawyers?
That is a great question. And I haven't really thought about that necessarily for the profession. I think there's lots of places where that can come in. I think of CLE as a really potential opportunity that could be utilized in a much more fruitful way. In it, as an example, like I think sitting in on something is not, and passively receiving information is really different than engaging with other people. And so I think that there's probably lots of ways in which, particularly after an individual's been admitted to practice law, that there are ways that we are checking in and making sure that those attributes are being upheld. Again, a great question for your next panel.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Professor Muckamal. As we prepare to wrap up, I'm not going to say bye just yet. I'm going to give you one last chance if you'd like. If there's anything else that you would like to say, any final concluding thoughts you'd like to share before we do take a short break and then move into our panel. You're not obligated, but any final thoughts you'd like to share with our group?
I just want to thank you again, and I want to encourage everybody to read Deborah's essay because it's quite brilliant. And as one of the last pieces of her scholarship, I think it's really, it's a beautiful testament to her body of work.
Great. Thank you so much. We're really grateful for you being with us today. Thanks for the work that you've done in California to make the legal profession more accessible. We're looking forward to the conversation continuing with our panel in just a few minutes. So thank you, Professor Muckamal, for being here and filling in for your colleague, Professor Rohde.